Did you ever find Bugs Bunny attractive when he'd put on a dress and play a girl bunny?
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho, the pot of thunder and rock and roll. The remedy for boredom has arrived, and it's here. It's Friday.
Isn't that special?
And we're going to kick off the weekend with a funny, funny guy. We've had a lot of funny guys on the show over the last few weeks, few months. That's what we want here. We want this to be a laugh riot, man. That's why we're doing this. But this could be the funniest guest we've ever had. Dana Carvey is here.
Howdy, partner.
The greatest, funniest, most hilarious cast member in SNL history, in my opinion. He's also bringing a whole slew of his closest friends, including former President George Bush.
As you can see, I got my Nikes. Just that.
Adam Sandler, Johnny Carson.
That is some weird, wild stuff.
Garth Algar from Wayne's World.
Swing.
Climbing up the rope at gym class. Make me feel funny.
Give me the worst Garth impression ever. The Stones, Keith Richards is here. Neil Young, that's a obscure reference. And all four members of the Beatles, including George Harrison. He's got all those guys here. He's got great stories about the church lady.
Well, your naked breasts are oiled up nicely.
Chris Farley, Phil Hartman, and all of his SNL life, the time that he had there. And wait until you hear how he became involved in Wayne's World and who really inspired the Garth Algar character.
She makes me feel funny. Like climbing the rope in gym class.
He's also talking drum solos, both Garth's solo in Wayne's World and the church lady's crazy infamous drum solo on SNL. Dana has a new reality competition show, First Impressions. It's on the USA Network. It's airing Tuesday nights at 10:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We're going to talk all about that. And too, we're going to talk about the art of the impression, the art of comedy. Dana Carvey's Comedy Clinic is about to get underway.
Showing.
All right, so we got Dana Carvey coming up. I just want to tell you how this came to be. I want to give the assist to Dennis Miller, who was my 200th guest here on Talk is Jericho back in December. I met Dennis when we did a pilot for the History Channel, which hasn't been greenlit or been rejected. It's been like 6 months already. It's like Dennis said, he goes,
if it's not dead yet, then it's barely breathing, babe. The heartbeat's getting slower as we go.
Anyways, I had a good relationship with Dennis, became friends with him, and I just texted him one day and I said, hey, is there any way you could hook me up with Dana Carvey's publicist? He said, I'll get Carvey for you. He's a great guy. You got to do it. I kind of sound like a cross between Dan Aykroyd and George Bush.
We're on a mission from God. Not going to do it. Not going to do it.
Anyways, impressions is not my thing. But he hooked me up with Dana, Dana's publicist, and he kept calling Carvey. Has Carvey called you yet? No, he hasn't. He kept calling Dana until finally they made it so. So thank you so much to Dennis Miller for the assist in setting up this great interview with one of his best friends and one of the funniest guests I've ever had on Talk is Jericho. Ladies and gentlemen, I unleash the comedic genius of Dana Carvey.
To fight my demonic urges, I popped a butter rum lifesaver and sucked away like there was no tomorrow.
All right.
It sounds fancy.
You like that? It's like smooth jazz. Hey, on the line.
Well, I mean, I've done podcasts where people are like, you know, it's basically a little microphone comes out of their wallet or something, you know.
Like, and here's the thing. We're talking with the legendary Dana Carvey. Can I say that? Is that weird to say the legendary Dana Carvey?
Well, it's funny. When I did a movie with Kirk Douglas and Burt Lancaster, for your listeners over 40, they were the superstar movie stars. So I did their last movie together. And when I met Kirk Douglas, first of all, through the voice, I met him, and I'm meeting my hero. This is like, you know, and I'm like, hi, I'm Dana, I play Richie. And he says, well, you're perfect. You're exactly what we need. You know, so I go, wow, he really talks like that. And I said, well, you're a legend. He said, don't say that. It sounds like I'm almost dead. So I didn't really know. Eventually, you get to an age where everyone's just sort of happy the old guy's doing it, and this could be the last time.
Right.
And I don't know if I've entered that phase, but yeah, it seems I get warm welcomes wherever I go. Like, hey, he's actually still doing it.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, it's funny because you go right into this wicked impression, and you know, I was just thinking about when I was looking at, I actually did a little research for this, and the fact that you just did the church lady last week. It's like huge news. If you Google Dana Carvey, the first thing that comes up is like 50 different links on you reprising the church lady, which is such a beloved character that you created. When you do something like that, does it surprise you, like you said, that people still freak out over the fact that Carvey's doing Church Lady, turn the channel?
Yeah, because it's because of the, I mean, the last time I did it, the explosion of the web, I guess we had it, but it's just more explosive now, because I think I did it when I hosted 6 years ago. But this time, it's just all these news sites are just so hungry for anything, and the fact that it had a political nature and Cruz had just dropped out. But, yeah, I was surprised at the amount of matriculation that I saw. You know, all I see is the mistakes and that I was too busy to really work on it as much as I normally do.
Right. So,
but there were a few good lines. It just didn't have that pop. You know, she's ultimately a prosecuting attorney, so there should be this back and forth. And we was it. But, you know, everyone did the best they could. Under, you know, normally I just focus on Saturday Night Live, but I was doing press all week. And I came off shooting a stand-up special in Boston. So I was kind of, I was down a court, as they say. I was a wee bit tired.
It's interesting, though. Like, you know, when you watch, you sound like you're a lot like me. Like, people can freak out about a performance that you do. And all you can see is the one or two things like, oh, I should have paused there longer. Or why didn't I emphasize this word? And other people would go, no, it was great. But the only person that can tell you it was great is how you feel about it afterwards. Do you find that?
Oh, completely. If there's probably only been 10 sketches, you know, the Pepper Boy or Tom Brokaw or a couple of Carsons here and there, a few church chats where I would come off Saturday Night Live and go, okay, that's an A+. That's as good as I can do. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the time, you're just compromising a little bit because you know, you're sort of, oh, I missed that. I rushed that. Oh, I shouldn't have. You know, for example, when and Daryl did a long obfuscating thing about Trump, kind of BSing that he was religious. Mm-hmm. And the dress audience was so hot that I needed to pause and then do it in that special. But the air audience was good, but they weren't as hot. So I took a long pause, but it just sort of went, oh, you know, so little things like that. But in the big picture, I know and accept it, and it's extremely flattering. Like, if I saw Tim Conway live in concert, and he was doing the dentist character, hits himself with the numbing stuff and going around, I wouldn't be thinking, is this his best numb dentist guy I've ever seen? I would just be like, he's doing it.
Right.
He actually said, isn't that special? So I understand, but I just, you know, find that I'm driven the same way as if I was just auditioning to be in show business. I don't know why. It might be a mental illness.
Mm-hmm. That's a perfectionist, though. You know, that's the art of a true professional, maybe, you know, that sort of vibe. Were you a big fan of Tim Conway? As soon as you mentioned his name, I'm like, I can see a lot of similarities between some of the bits that you've done and Tim Conway.
Well, I hope I was influenced by him. I think that there's two categories of influence in a sense. Like, there's the cool influences. So a lot of comedians in my age group, they want to adopt Lenny Bruce or Richard Pryor, or, you know, it's hip. Mm-hmm. And certainly those are influences. But then there was these variety show people when I was a little kid, you know, Flip Wilson, you know, Tim Conway,
right,
and Harvey Korman. And so they don't have like a hip thing about their legacy, like cool. Mm-hmm. But to me, they're incredibly cool. I mean, Tim Conway has done stuff that's at a brilliant level, like kind of a crazy level of comedy. But he's not considered cool. So I don't know what age your listeners are, but
every age.
Every age. There was a show growing up called Wild Wild West, and it was a Western. I don't know if you remember it. And it was they made a movie.
They made a movie, Will Smith and the Giant Spider.
Yeah, exactly. That didn't work out. But the TV show was super hip, and there was sort of a master disguise character, a sidekick to the cool guy, played by an actor named Ross Martin. And, you know, I'd see him, and he'd be the Chinese guy with makeup, and then he'd be the bartender, and he'd have a big mustache, you know. And years later, I was on Tom Schneider's show when he was still around in the 90s, and I mentioned Ross Martin as an influence, and no one had ever mentioned him. And so I got a nice letter from his widow a couple months later. Thanks for mentioning Ross. It's so great. No one ever mentions Ross. So there's unheralded people sure. who influenced all of us that sometimes you want to shine a spotlight on. You know, really, remember that guy?
Yeah, sure. I used to love the fact, like, watching the Carol Burnett show when I was just a little kid, about how the highlight was always when Conway could make Corman start laughing. If you could see that, it was like you felt like you were part of something special, because they always at some point just start laughing in the middle of the sketch.
I know, and that was, he would surprise him while they were doing, it was live to tape, but he would change things and intentionally do all that. When I got on SNL, I mean, Lorne had come through and was a writer for Laugh-In, Lorne Michaels, and was around that era. And we were told early on in 86 with me and Phil and Jan, Kevin and Dennis, not to break. You know, and we were terrified to break. That's just Carol Burnett. It was considered old hat, old-fashioned cornball. And so we never really broke. Phil did a couple times, so we were terrified. And then Sandler brought in his own style where he would sort of break, and then Jimmy Fallon did. And now it's sort of a cool thing to do again. But I came through the phase where I couldn't really break and didn't want to break. I mean, this is like a little bit of a digression, but you kind of don't want to break if the sketch is going great. Because a lot of times if the wig falls off, everybody breaks. But if the sketch is going really good, you don't want it to be about that everyone cracked up. Because I was doing the Pepper Boy with Adam Sandler. I don't know if you know that one. You like a pepper or you want the pepper? So every time we got to Farley, who could lay you out with one line, he goes, "Why, I like some pepper, what?" And Sandler would always laugh. So on the air show, it's going really good. We're getting huge laughs. And for a restaurant sketch, you're like, "Pepper, yes, you like it. Killing." And then Farley does his line, and Sandler starts to break. So he turns away from the camera and toward me, and his face is shaking. And I leaned into him with the Italian accent and said, "Don't break." I didn't want that sketch to be about breaking.
Right. It's funny that you mentioned that, because I often say, like, and we can talk about this in a bit, how that was almost the true golden era of Saturday Night Live, because you guys kind of rescued the franchise at all of these amazing, you know, talents that became A-listers for years to come. But I always think to me that Farley's idea in his mind was, I'm going to make these guys break. Even if I only have one line, and the sketch I always use as an example is that exact one, because he has one line, like, "Why, yes, I'd love some pepper." And it's like so obnoxious with the big stupid sideburns. It seems like he was just out there just trying to get you guys to fall for it.
Yeah, I mean, Farley, Chris, you know, was, a force of nature, obviously. I mean, I've never seen anything in the history of the show. You know, maybe if you want to go back to it, when Eddie Murphy was kind of bouncing off the screen, going, "Get in a hot tub." You know, he was with Chris when he dug down deep, you know, in the van down by the river sketch. I never seen energy like that come off the screen, you know. So he could just lay you out. And he had a mischievous, childlike thing. He was whip smart. He kind of played the dumb guy in life. I would tease him about it. "Come on, Chris, you know." He was very smart. He knew exactly what he was doing. But you're right. I mean, I think that when Phil and Mike Myers and the people I mentioned, the show was coming back really strong. And then around 90, we got our sort of backup. For the first time, Lorne brought in backup. And, of course, it was, you know, Sandler, Bade, Farley, Chris Rock, Tim Meadows, probably missing some. And then
Schneider.
When we gelled together in those 3 years, at least for me, 90 to 93, that was the peak years, because we had just so many weapons.
It's an all-star cast of guys and girls.
And, you know, Sandler would come knock on my door when he wanted to do Opperman. And he'd go, "Hi, Carvey, I'm doing this this character called Opperman. Would you mind introducing it?" You know. Of course I did. It was great.
How crazy was that schedule? Because from what I understand, SNL is pretty much a 5-6 night a week job between rehearsals and writing and kind of being on that carousel.
You kind of have a pit in your stomach at the beginning of the week, like, here we go again, you know. You meet the host, and it's really just pressure, you know. A lot of weeks you just didn't really have anything, didn't really understand quite how the show worked initially, like what Lauren was looking for in terms of a first, second, and third act. So, you know, eventually I started partnering up with people. Bonnie and Terry Turner were great for Church Lady. And Al Franken for the political stuff when Bush came in, and Jim Downey. And that really helped me. And then Robert Smigel later on We did a lot of stuff together. He's probably, if I had to make an all-star team, like, you know, of sketch comedy writers, he would be like the number one draft pick. He would be like the Steph Curry of sketch.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes he's the only guy I could just riff like as Regis or Johnny Carson. And then the next day the script would be better than what I could have done, you know.
So
he's just really gifted.
When you were talking about Bush, like, is that something where, he's, you know, the Saturday Night Live is actually seems like it always thrives during an election year like it is right now. So does Lorne come in there and say, like, we need someone to play Bush, who's going to do it? Or is this a character that you've been working on? Or did you just say, well, I can try it?
No, it just came to me by accident because Phil was doing Reagan,
right,
and Clinton, and Lovitz looked swarthy, you know, because Dukakis was Reagan, so John did that,
right.
And it was just Bush was left over to me, and I couldn't really do it, and there wasn't much there. He just seemed like a technocrat, kind of a flat, whiny, after Reagan being, well, here we go again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it took me a while to create a character out of it. I think it took me a good year, and then once I hooked into it, and the audience hooked into it, it was a blast. I did a lot of cold openings with George Bush Sr., and took a lot of liberty. It was the one thing when you're in a lockdown camera for that length of time, you can improvise. I remember the breakthrough for me was one night, you know, I'd been on the show a while. I just said the cue cards are suggestions. It's a way to free yourself up from being locked in word for word. So I'd be gone out there coming at you, and all that stuff made it really pop. So it was this is kind of a funny aside, but when Bush Sr. won the election in 1988, John Lovett called me to concede and congratulate me before the real Dukakis called George Bush Sr. Because he knew and I knew you'll be in a lot of cold openings. Congratulations, you're the president of comedy. And I knew what he meant. Yeah, it was a very lucky break.
I guess that's something to think about. You really are hoping that Bush gets in because then you'll get more airtime on the show.
Oh, yeah. John wanted Dukakis and I wanted Bush. Yeah, absolutely. We wanted to have that bully pulpit to wind it down. And John had a really funny Dukakis, and he would have been absolutely great as Dukakis. But, you know, my guy won. And so, yeah, he called me early in the evening to, once he saw the results coming in.
did you ever meet up with Bush and do that for him to his face? Or did that ever happen?
Oh, yeah, like 100 times. I mean, after he lost the election, he invited me to the White House. And I've told this story before, but, I mean, he was, people thought he was really depressed. He was a one-term president.
Mm-hmm.
And he just called me up, and I actually was on the phone with John Lovett. And I got call waiting. And what you hear when the president calls you is he says, this is the White House operator number one. Please hold for the president. Eerie, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I go back to John. I got John, I gotta go. And he goes, what, you have a bigger name? So then I've got Bush talking to me, President Bush, you know. I thought he'd come out, cheer up the troops, keep a little down, want to bring him up. And I was so young and naive, I just thought, well, where would I stay? He was already thinking, where would I stay, like what hotel? Well, I stay with Barr and I right here in the White House. And so we ended up, my wife and I, in the White House for 2.5 days with them, hanging out with them, dinner, went to the Kennedy Center honorees. We just really became friends at that point. And then we did charity events throughout the years and different, you know, I hosted and he beamed in. And so became good friends, really. Yeah.
It's so weird. Amazing. Like, I can do one impression, like, in my whole plethora of things, and it's the drummer of Metallica, Lars Ulrich. And
know him well.
Yeah, Dana, it's pretty cool to be talking to you right now. It's such a fucking cool thing to be here. Something has never really done before. And so when I finally met Lars and did that for him, he's kind of looking at me like, I don't sound like that. And it's like, well, you kind of do. He's like, well, I really don't. With Bush or whoever, when you meet these guys, is it ever almost like an insult for them?
No, he loved it and adopted it. And I was always hearing that in his speeches, he was going, you know, wouldn't be prudent at this juncture. And the trick we would do for some of the debates we did together is I'd be out there doing Bush Sr. and doing it really over the top. Got it, education, you know. And then he'd be slowly walking up behind me as if I couldn't see him, but the audience would. They went crazy for that. But he had a complete sense of humor about it. He said, never hit below the belt, you know. My style is to keep them guessing. I wasn't like Bill Maher or other comedian, John Stewart, or Dennis, or comedians who come from a specific well-known political point of view. I was sort of the old school. I was kind of like, well, where is he? What side is he on? Because I find, for me personally, it's really fun to have anybody doubt their ideology just when they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Once you announce yourself, then you got to play to your choir.
Yeah.
But it's fun sometimes to, you know, do it in a roundabout way. But yeah, Bush loved it. It was really a trip.
All right, you guys know that I travel every week for AEW, and I'm on the road for Fozzy as well. But I don't worry about appliances or any of the stuff at my house breaking down while I'm gone, because we've got American Home Shield. And truthfully, I'm not a fix-it-myself guy anyway, so even if I was home and we had a leaky faucet or a faulty water heater, I'm not the one who's going to fix it. And unexpected breakdowns like that won't break your bank with American Home Shield warranty, because covered repairs and replacements are taken care of just like that. You just choose a plan that works for you and your budget, and then when a covered item in your home breaks, contact American Home Shield, and their trusted and qualified pros will fix or replace it based on the coverage in your agreement. Right now, you can get 20% off. Just go to ahs.com/Jericho and save that 20%. That's ahs.com/Jericho for 20% off any plan. American Home Shield, don't worry, be warranty. See ahs.com/contracts for coverage details, including limit amounts, fees, limitations, and exclusions. New Jersey residents, the product being offered is a service contract and is separate and distinct from any product or service warranty which may be provided by the home or building manufacturer.
Game on!
You're such a great impressionist, which has been part of your thing, and the show that we're talking about is called First Impressions, which is basically you giving impressionist impersonators like tests and trying to make them, it's kind of like find out America's best impressionist. And you're basically, right? Is that kind of what we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it was just there's singer shows, this and that. So they offered me six on the air. They go, we want to do an impressionist competition show. And I thought, well, that should exist somewhere. But I always thought it wouldn't sustain with the voice of the American Idol, like a four-month season.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't think that would work because it's too limited in a way. There's really like 15 or 20 voices you can do. But they said, oh, no, we'll do a half-hour episode. We'll just have three come on. You'll interact with them a little bit, riff with them. And then it was like bite-sized, just friendly. And so so I said, well, I don't want to be a judge. I just want to be kind of off to the side riffing, and I want to have a friend with me. And so they kept saying yes to everything I asked. So I kind of had to do it.
That's because of your legendary status, obviously.
I guess. I mean, you know, look, I hear Frank Caliendo or Kevin Pollak, stuff they do, I'm in awe of. I mean, I still consider it a tool that I use comedically, because I'm ultimately Church Lady and, you know, Garth are more, I'm more known for characters really than impressions. But I enjoy watching people do impressions, especially ones that I can't do or if they do it better than me. I do find it very just entertaining to watch an impressionist. It's very entertaining.
And I guess I have a kind of a two-pronged question here, but if you're talking about an impression, like you just mentioned, like you take a Bush, like there's nothing really to impersonate, but when you can find something, everyone goes, wow, that's exactly it. How do you put together your impressions? Do you watch somebody and go, oh, I could do this little bit that no one would? Like, what's the secret to doing a good impression?
Well, for my money, it's a little bit of abstracting or, you know, bringing out little things that they do and not worrying for me personally, but I don't have that gear like Frank Caliendo where it's perfectly accurate, but it just feels accurate, you know?
Mm-hmm.
When I do Trump now, I'm just playing with it, but, you know, everybody does this, okay, this guy down here, and this is certainly part of it, but it's also up here, okay? These guys are crazy. I mean, he has that upper register too, so, and he says, okay, so I just exaggerate it. So we're down here, this is like if he was a Batman villain, you'll never get away with this, Trump.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I will, okay? Because I'm the Trump god. Okay, 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 okay. So I just exaggerated. And for Obama, I noticed that there were three Obamas. And there's the very low-key, you know, very methodical, and there's Obama at a press conference, and then there's Obama out on the stump, like at a college or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very much, you know, upper register. They don't want to do anything. They're not going to cooperate. And then if you come down into the center, then you kind of tussle it right down the middle. and you just trip off that last word. Like, if you say that's not true, he would say, that's not true. That's not true. So I'm trying to find the rhythms and define them. And the first 4 years of his administration, it wasn't really connecting. After he got reelected, people relaxed, mm-hmm. you know. Because the first African-American president, I guess, you know, I'm Norwegian or something. So there was a sensitivity to it. But they definitely, the audience relaxed. And then it started to be my biggest character in my act mm-hmm. for a period of time, you know, until Trump came in.
Right. Who was your first impression that you did when you were like a kid? Like, did you just do it when you were like 8 years old for your parents or something?
When I was 9 years old, we had an encyclopedia, Caller's Encyclopedia, and they would send you a long-running vinyl LP of the events of the year. And on the B side, at the very end, was the Beatles talking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, big phenomenon. And they were talking, you know, there's all this thing, and we don't know if we're going to last or whatever, we're doing it. You know, we know what we're doing. And so that was the first, you know, I was able to, within a couple of days, even though I had three older brothers, I could go around talking kind of like a beetle. I went up to my mother one morning and I said, Mom, do you think I could get me some pancakes? You know, so that was the beginning. Oh, my God, he sounds like a beetle. And then I had a tape recorder that I finally got in sixth grade, a little reel-to-reel tape recorder. I would tape Jonathan Winters and Rich Little. I did it just secretly in my room. I never took theater arts. I was sort of an introverted extrovert or extroverted introvert. But I did dream of being just a comedian on TV somehow when I was nine. You know?
Yeah.
So and it started early.
You know, it's interesting. There's a movie called Walk Hard that came out a couple of years ago with John C. Reilly. It was kind of like a Johnny Cash spoof.
Yeah.
And he meets up with the Beatles. And it was great because we're talking about like Justin Long did a George Harrison, which, once again, who can do a George Harrison? And for whatever reason, he nailed it. And it was so funny because you can do a John and a Paul, but who does a George? And he did it. That was the perfect example of just finding this little weird thing and making it into, that sounds just like him.
Yeah, and that would be a matter of homework. Mm-hmm. You know, I do it in my stand-up. I do a long 5-minute conversation between John Lennon and Paul McCartney.
Oh, really?
Just about working with Kanye West. And then they get into what is the web, you know, what's Facebook? You know, Facebook, John, is a place where you share your life with the world. Oh, so there's sort of that nasally lower register of John. And Paul was all like that. But, yeah, certainly George has something in the middle bow. You know, the little puddlings. He has a sort of rhythm that he does. That's part of it. You know, he was the middle harmony guy. But, you know, so for my generation, you know, I was just, that was it. I mean, because my brother and I were, the one closest to me, we had a band called The Surfers. I had a clothes hamper that I would kick for a bass drum. Mm-hmm. And I had Hardy Boys book and drumsticks that I stole from Mickey Hart's store because I didn't realize I would shoplift these drumsticks in my hometown, Laurel Avenue in San Carlos, California. And I ran into the Grateful Dead at the Four Seasons years later. And Mickey Hart, the drummer, said he owned a music store on Laurel Avenue. So I handed him $10.
How do you steal drumsticks? Put them down your pants?
Oh, yeah. Right down the pants. Little innocent kid. Boom. Oh, we all shoplifted for a period of time until I got caught. Yeah, we put... My brother Brad, who I based Garth on, was more of a scientist about it. Like, we'd be over in a record store, and he would have slowly gotten a full LP right under his jacket. And he would just say to me, I could take it. I could take it if I wanted to. And then he would put it back. So he was, you know... They put bicycle parts down my pants. It was just juvenile delinquents, basically.
I remember I went to Florida with my parents when I was probably 8, and we went to a 7-Eleven, and I shoplifted a pack of Starburst, and I put them down the front. I remember I was wearing gray sweatpants, and as I was walking out, a guy put his hand on my shoulder and said, take those out of your pocket right now. And all I could think of is, please don't let my dad see this. And the guy just took it out of my pocket and put it back. But thank God he didn't tell my dad. I still remember that to this day. I would have gotten so much trouble for getting caught shoplifting Starburst. It's not even something cool like drumsticks.
I didn't. I had a secret pocket in my jacket. Remember, I was 4 feet tall. I was 8, 9 years of age. And I had shoplifted a yo-yo. And I was on my Stingray at the getaway, right? And then the guy just grabbed the back of the banana seat of the Stingray. So that was it. Yeah, that was rough. Because my older brother completely corrupted me, totally.
Well, that's what older brothers are for, right?
Right. And then, of course, they were like, I can't believe you shoplifted that. Jeez.
did you ever impersonate your dad or your brothers at all?
Oh, yeah. Well, Brad is Garth.
Uh-huh. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Brad is Garth. I mean, he's the character I based Garth on. If we could put him on the phone, he'd go, hi, this is Brad. I could talk like this. So he is Garth. I mean, there's a part of Garth that was kind of the stoner dude. Go away. But the quiet Garth is just totally Brad. This is great. If you're going to spew into this. Completely Brad. That's why in the first movie he had the stun gun and all that. And I talked to Brad about the viability of Garth being a science nerd kid. That was all based on Brad. You know?
So do you ask his permission? Like, hey, Brad, I got this character. It's kind of based on you. Do you mind if I do it? Or you just kind of do it and go, hey, check it out.
I just did it and he loved it because it was just a cool character to be associated with. You know, he was very successful himself, or is. He developed the first prototype for home video recording called the Video Toaster in the 90s. So he was, we sort of got together with that. I'm a very funny family. I mean, my sister Lori is just someone who just asks questions that she knows the, you know, she's just kind of an innocent. Why are you doing a podcast, Dane? Why don't you do these things? And it's just a friend. What do you talk about, Dane? You know, that. You know, how long is it? It's about 45 minutes. Why is it that long, Dane? So there's him. And then my dad would talk like this. Oh, you big dummy. Oh, Jesus Christ. You don't know what you're doing. So that was him. And my mother talked like this. I think all my children are wonderful.
He must have drove him nuts with those impersonations, man.
My brother Scott is someone who's very emotional. Like, if you go to his house and he goes for the Heide key and it's not there, I go, you don't have a Heide key? I don't know where it is. I'll have 1,000 Heide keys tomorrow. I'll live in a Heide key. Right now, I don't have a Heide key. You saw it. I put it. It's been there 1,000 times. That's Scott. I haven't really developed all of them yet on stage, but I should.
But you mentioned before about being in a band, and you started out, you know, hitting a Hardy Boys book as a drum. I was going to ask you about this. The Church Lady busted out a wicked drum solo at one time. Garth plays drums. Obviously, you play drums. Did you ever play drums in a band?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, mostly garage bands and stuff, and weddings. And my brother Scott got a guitar to garage sale for $1 with one string. So he learned Louie Louie, and we were off at the races. I mean, he came back when he was 12. He got to go in seventh grade up to the Fillmore West in 1967 or 8. And he goes, I just saw the best guitar player in the world. I go, what's his name? He goes, I think it's Jimmy Hendrix. Well, we played a lot. And look, if I'd had the talent to be a rock star or whatever, I would have done that.
Who were some of the drummers that you kind of got influenced from?
Well, back in the day, you know, Carmen Appice or Beck Bogart and Appice, I saw them, you know.
Yeah.
Cozy Powell, who really was
classic.
Great with the hi-hat, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you look back, I mean, you got to give it up. I mean, John Bonham, I mean, there's kind of only, I mean, he's, you know, I love Keith Moon. I mean, I think the first side of Who's Next is a masterwork on every level, and mm-hmm. his drumming is just gorgeous. And at least three times a year, I go on YouTube and watch. There's a Buddy Rich drum solo where I just sit in awe of his one-handed rolls. You know, I'm very perfunctory. I do a little guitar, a little keyboard, and a little bit of drums, but I love all of it.
Yeah, well, you can tell that's like one of the best things when the Church Lady busted out the drum solo, because you would never expect it, and that's why it worked so well, because you could actually do it.
Yeah, and that one came off because I hadn't drummed in a while, mm-hmm. and that one on air kind of came off. That's the better solo. It's more organic, and it flows nicer, and I'm doing the Ringo. And when I did, I had time to rehearse the drum solo for Wayne's World, and I had a really nice, tight Yamaha jazz set with small drums, very low, all right around me, you know, because mm-hmm. I'm not a big reacher. And then they came in the day of the thing and they go, they had this gigantic drum set because they wanted more publicity for Yamaha drums. I didn't blame them, you know.
Right.
So that's kind of, I said, well, then give me the red set, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I had that for a while, and then I gave it to my brother's cousin, but the solo was not as good as it could have been because I had to reach.
Gotcha, yeah, with the bigger kit.
See, I mean, the perfectionist thing, I think about those things.
Still to this day, right?
if I think about it right now. But the Church Lady one came off very nicely organic. I like that one. That felt very, I was felt really on top of it.
And plus it's live. It's not like take one, take it from this angle, do it again. It's you had one chance to nail it.
Yes, that's the beauty of live. I mean, do you play instruments or?
I do. I do. I mean, I could play that drum solo that you played. You know, the kind of the classic Ringo drum solo. You know, just as long as you get that foot tapping the bass drum and you don't lose it, you got it.
Yeah, that's the key. I mean, I've gotten so weak because I got a virtual reality Roland drum set, which gives you a lot. I mean, they're really fun, but. Then you go to an acoustic set, and you're just like, what happened?
Yeah. You're talking about those plastic ones where the cymbal is like a black rubber ring, and you hit it?
They're brilliant. I mean, at one point they made a leap, and I went into a music store and just went, holy wow. It's not like the rubber thing that is really touch sensitive, and it's pretty remarkable and really fun. So you still get to do the thing. I drum in the car. I spit beats and drum in the car. I drum on my computer. I'm always kind of drumming
something. Let's talk a little bit about your Johnny Carson imitation, because that was one of my favorites that you used to do. You probably still do it. Is that something that you did for Johnny as well?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I went on Johnny six times, I believe.
And six times. Wow.
I started doing it around the office. Just that, is that right? That is weird, wild stuff. I did not know that. And once again, Robert Smigel just loved it so much. So we worked on that together. And that was probably, in a way, one of my favorite things I've ever done on the show, because it was so dry and quiet. It wouldn't even get really big laughs, but it felt like the funniest thing I did on the show at the time. And I loved being out there with Phil.
Mm-hmm.
But just that explaining. For those of you at home that don't know, you're watching a thing called television. You know, just that. And when we did Carcinio.
Yeah.
You know, a crib is not exactly where a baby sleeps. That's kind of where that's like their house. Did you know that? I did not know that. So it was, and then eventually Johnny got a little perturbed by it. So.
Did he?
There was one episode which I thought was a little mean. I fought against it, but we did it anyway. And they made Johnny a little cynical and senile.
Oh, one of the sketches that you did on SNL?
Yeah, and then Jay Leno told me later that Johnny would go down the hall. They're making fun of me now. It's time to go. But he was the best and brilliant, and he was very nice to me. I mean, when you were out there with Johnny Carson as a guest, he is just 100% for you. He was.
Was this?
And,
sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to let you know something I do, Johnny 2016, just for my friend.
Uh-huh.
I just, it's just him being pulled over on the PCH, you know, a different time of drinking and driving, and describes the kind of drink he had and where he had it at. Just that's what makes me laugh. Oh, sorry, officer, I didn't know I was speeding. I had two slippery monkeys at the Hook and Crook. Just makes me laugh. Two slippery monkeys at the Hook and Crook.
But emphasizing the crook, the Hook and Crook.
The Hook and Crook. I had two frozen soldiers at the Windy Summit. Yeah, he just had a voice and an Ed McMahon. So that's for our generation. But about 6 months ago, my son, who's 23, just said, "Hey, Dad, who is Johnny Carson?"
Ooh, wow, yeah, it's hard to believe.
That's the best of it. Yeah,
you know, did you ever do Johnny before you were on SNL?
No, I didn't. I just started doing it when I was there, I think, after going on with him a few times. I just developed that because I'd seen Rich Little do it.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole thing of I did not, is that weird wild stuff, that sort of other quieter Johnny.
You're right.
Yeah. So
what did
that
you,
was really satisfying.
What did you do for your Saturday Night Live audition? Did you have to do some impressions on that?
Yeah, there was a piano. I did Chopped Broccoli. I did a little bit of Church Lady. I did this lost British character. I probably did some Jimmy Stewart. You know, this is back in the 80s. I did a lot of little voices and stuff. I was very, very, very fortunate to get that show.
So are you doing it right for Lauren? Is he sitting right there watching you?
Yeah, and like maybe four other people, and they're not smiling or laughing. That's the second audition. The first one was, which he said basically he hired me from when he saw me at a comedy club on the West Side. Doing 45 minutes, he brought Cher with him, and that he said that he wanted me right then and there. So So that, and I'd auditioned three times before and never got it, but Lauren had never seen it.
Oh, really? Okay. And that's the secret.
I had a Disney face. I didn't really look like a comedian, you know, and people would pass over me a lot. So I thanked Lauren again. I saw him Saturday after that. I said, because anytime you have like a coach, Lauren's like a really good coach in my regard, because he saw something in me before I saw something in me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I thought I might do okay, but he thought I would really do great once my confidence got up. So that was nice. It ended up being a good experience. It can be a very tricky show, but I was lucky to do the church lady on my very first show.
Oh, that was the first show you brought it in.
Well, it was the last sketch on the practice show, and then it killed so hard it moved up to the first sketch on the very first show, and I'd never done sketch comedy in my life.
Hmm.
I had to keep stopping from looking at the audience every time they laugh, like a stand-up.
Right.
It was new. I just never done it, but, you know, I had such great, I had Bill Hartman and Jan Hooks and, you know, John Lovitz, you know, had some really powerful.
It seems like you always had really good chemistry with Phil Hartman. He's one of the most funniest guys that was ever on the show.
Yeah, Phil was the kind of guy who's like, he would just assume he'll be in the background, he'll just service the sketch, but if you want him to go to the lead, and he'll do that. Yeah, there was just it was very easy with Phil. When we did Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon, it's just, every time I looked at him, I laughed. You know, Phil was a kind of effortless, you know, he just had so much talent, he was almost bored by it. He'd much rather talk about Evan Rude, outboard motors and stuff. Seriously, he was a renaissance man. He'd come over and play the blues. And
oh, really? Guitar
to the
player?
Airport. Excuse me?
He's a guitar player?
He was kind of an everything, yeah. He played the guitar. He played the guitar. He was designed Poco's album. He was an artist. He loved his airplane. We'd go to the airport and just put on headsets and just listen to air traffic and look at his airplane. He had his boat, go on his boat. You know, Phil was just he lived around the corner from me and my wife and our kids, and we all still keep in touch, you know.
Yeah.
We were very, very close. So it was it's another bizarre tragedy, you know. But Bren was a really cool, loyal person. I mean, that was just a psychotic break and drugs, and so it was... I miss Phil. I miss him. You know, when I go to SNL, I really kind of, you know, you see the pictures in the hallway, and you know, you kind of want Phil to be out there too with you. You know, Jan too was great. Jan Hooks, my God,
she was hilarious as well. Yeah, probably one of the funniest women that have ever been on the show.
She was. She was right up there. There's been such strong women on that show in the last 10 years, but Jan would be right in there with you know, Amy, Maya, Kristen Wiig, Kate McGinnon, Tina Fey. I mean, it's just been amazing, the strength of the women cast members in the last 10 years, hasn't it?
I mean, oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think the fact that they're doing, I think the Ghostbusters remake that they're doing with the all-female cast, I think three of the girls are SNL, either they're on the show now or alumni. I mean, that's huge.
I know. It's a trip, isn't it?
So just a couple more questions, just talking about the chemistry that you had with a couple guys. Like, when you're talking about, like, would you say that Garth is your most well-known character, or would it be Church Lady?
I would say in the long run, they may be neck and neck now, but I would say Garth because of the movie. And there's YouTube videos here and there, but the movie just floats around, and the movie's very evergreen. Whereas Church Lady would talk about different political events at the time, kind of. But the movie, everyone knows or knew Wayne and Garth, two losers in the town that are happier than anybody else for no apparent reason.
Yeah, but that's why it connected, because they were just every man. Like you mentioned, especially that time frame, the stoner rocker guys. Like, I was that age group when you guys were doing it. It's like, this is me and my friends, like in that Bohemian Rhapsody in the car. I mean, that's my life. That's it. You nailed it.
Yeah, yeah, and that really hurt. You know, I was like 36 doing that thing all night with your neck going. it was, you know, Mike was a very clever writer. He's younger than me by about 8 years. And because I thought, well, didn't Bill and Ted do this? You know, but Mike took it to this whole other area and was a great construct. And I was able to, it was fun to be the sidekick, kind of the Ringo guy, you know, or something, you know. It's like the sweet, loyal sidekick, you know. It was a really, really fun thing to do. And I think the first movie was fast, low budget, and spontaneous, so it has a real spark to it. You know, first, that basic Wayne's World. So it's all surreal to me that that happened as well.
Did Mike come to you and say, I got this idea, or how did you guys hash that out?
He had done Wayne in Canada. He was a child actor, and he'd done Wayne. And I think when he came to SNL, he did Wayne's World. And I don't know if it was his suggestion or Lorne, but to have a sidekick. And he just said, your name is Garth, and you dig Wayne. So I saw his look, so then I just went with the blonde hair wig. I remember walking through the department with him. I'll wear the blonde wig and these glasses, you know. And then it just sort of happened spontaneously, but it ended up just, getting huge. I mean, we were just shocked by it, really, just shocked.
It's amazing when a character like that hits, how it just puts you in a completely different level.
Well, movies are timeless. I mean, it's a big part of the biggest movie that SNL ever put out. You know, it's just like, wow, you know, really, really flattering. And I just, Mike was great, and Bonnie and Terry Turner helped form the first script. And yeah, amazing, right?
Yeah, totally. And being such a musical guy and a musical fan, just getting ready to wrap it up. When you talk about, you know, SNL, one of the biggest things is the musical guests that show up, and you're talking about being a fan and being a drummer. Who was there a couple guests, the musical guests that showed up that kind of blew your mind as far as you never thought you'd get a chance to hang out with them or meet them or work with them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when Roy Orbison came on, it was like in the studio, like, wow, okay, that's the real deal. I remember being a huge Neil Young fan, as I am, hanging out with Neil. One night we went out to dinner with Neil, Phil and I, and a few people. I said to Phil, let's make Neil Young, let's just destroy him with comedy. So we just started going off on characters. Phil's doing a Japanese bomber pilot, and I'm doing the president. So we got Neil helpless intentionally.
Was he laughing?
Laughing his ass off. It was a very dry sense of humor. And this is one moment with Neil Young I'll never forget. So we're at the after party after drinks, and it's just so cool to talk to him. He's just really funny. And he looked up, he was having a glass of wine, he looked up, he saw Chris Farley, and he goes, that fat kid's funnier than shit. That was really awesome.
You nailed that. I'm from Winnipeg, just like Neil is, and that's the total Winnipeg accent. You got it.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that guy's funny, man. Holy shit, is he funny.
Oh, that guy's funnier than shit, eh? Yeah, it was. That, you know, and seeing, you know, hanging out with Eric Clapton, it was just too much overload. A lot of these people come on that show. Really?
Did you do a Jagger or did you a Keith? Did you Keith or Jagger?
I did Keith in a sketch with Mike. Yeah.
Right. Mike was Mick, and you were Keith.
Yeah.
You got it.
I was just doing the bumbly, well, this is a true story. When Keith Richards hosted during the dinner break, we had a horse on that show, so there was a horse tied up off to the side on 8H. And I was there working with some props. No one was around. And Keith Richards sort of staggered into view. He couldn't see me. And he goes up to the horse, and he puts the horse's head in his hands. And he goes, look at you. You're a f***ing horse. And then he just staggered away. Never forgot that. He just told the animal what it was and then walked away.
just to clarify it to that poor horse in case he's having any identity.
You're a f***ing horse. Yeah, never forgot that. But yeah, that was really cool.
Last question. What is the most obscure impression that you do?
I don't know if it's really obscure, but sometimes I just have fun. I don't even do it just for my wife and I. She likes Downton Abbey. This one's kind of goofy, but Downton Abbey is like this British, you know, there's the patriarch and the servants, but there's a character called Mr. Bates, but I changed it a little bit. So the matriarch is going, what on earth is wrong with Master Bates? Well, my lady, Master Bates disappears for long periods of time into his room where most unusual sounds are emitted, my lady. What can we do to find out what Master Bates is doing, Mr. Carson? So right now, any of your listeners who've seen that show are dying with laughter.
If you haven't seen it, it's still pretty damn funny, I'll tell you.
Well, have you seen The Walking Dead?
Yeah.
Well, I used to do the sheriff like he was always out of breath, and then the old guy who kind of comes back in dream sequences who lost his leg.
Herschel.
So be like, yeah, the sheriff Rick is like, we're not going that way. We're going that way. And Herschel's like, listen to yourself, Rick. You need cardio. you're out of breath. Listen to yourself. I'm not out of breath. That's another one I used to do. I do things that just half the audience. If you do impressions now, a lot of the audience doesn't know who they are. A certain amount will, but, you know, it's hard to get everyone to know who you're doing because it's also...
But isn't it the commitment, though? As long as you commit to it and stick with it, you'll always get a laugh.
Oh, totally. I think so, yeah. That's the number one thing you always have to remember is make yourself laugh inside when you're doing comedy. It's a tricky one, but, yeah, that's the best place to be, you know.
So. Yeah. Dana, you're great, man. It was awesome talking to you.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was really fun. Well, let's do it again sometime. You know, have me back in the fall or something.
I will. Actually,
promote my special.
Yeah, for sure. Dennis Miller set us up, and Dennis did this show, and he's a great guy. He's like, has Carvey called you yet? I'm like, no, but I'm sure he's busy. That's bullshit. I'm going to have him call you. I can't do Dennis like you can. But, yeah.
It was fun. I knew I'd get around to it. It was the busiest time of my life getting ready to do that special. It just put me underwater. But I love Dennis. He's a great guy. My IQ goes up when I talk to him and when I do him. Christ sakes, Jericho. Kind of hitting it out of the ballpark, you know? You're like F. Scott Fitzgerald up there. Speedball's coming right down at the lady, okay?
I was like, it's like a giant snake, and I was holding onto the tail just trying to keep up with him and trying to fake my way, pretending that I knew what he was talking about. And just, oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, he's like you said, a very smart guy, much smarter than I.
Oh, no. I mean, his vocabulary, he's got a Rolodex in his brain, and it's just effortless for him. And sometimes you figure out what he was saying later on. Really laugh. But, yeah, he's extraordinarily mental giant, really. I mean, it's just the way he can form words on his radio show. I used to be in awe and I'd watch him go 30, 40 seconds out to a commercial break, and he would just like lay out these words perfectly lined up, and then we'll be right back. Okay, good. All right. Carvey's on top of a rocket. Okay, he's riding that lady up into the sky. Okay. He rarely calls me Dana. He calls everyone their last name.
The last name, yeah. Yeah, Carvey. Yeah. All right, my man. We'll have you back when you do your special, and it's been great talking to you. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Dana.
Thank you.
Cheers, right, man.
Take care.
Bye.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Swing. Tentpole. She's a babe.
She's magically babelicious.
So episode 3 of Dana Carvey's new competition show, First Impressions, airs this Tuesday night at 10:30 p.m. EST. That's Eastern Standard Time on the USA Network. It's only a half hour. I think it's actually 10:30 all across the board. And the PST as well, which is specific. It's only half an hour. It's jam-packed with laughs, and they got some great contestants and great guest judges. John Lovitz has been on. Steve Carell was on the first episode. Kevin Nealon's coming up. Check out First Impressions on the USA Network, starring Dana Carvey and another Talk is Jericho alumni, Freddie Prinze Jr. is hosting. So check that out. And let me mention this one more time because it's such a great cause and getting down to the wire. Kevin Owens and Tyler Breeze have started a GoFundMe page for the victims of the Alberta fires. They're trying to raise $100,000 and they're over halfway there. So help out if you can. These people have lost everything, okay? Their homes, their clothes, personal items, everything. Every dollar helps. So please give what you can. You can get to the GoFundMe page through Kevin Owens' Twitter account. He's at Fight Owens Fight. Tyler is at Gorgeous, and that's MMM, 3Ms. And thanks to you guys for supporting them, and thanks you guys for supporting all the great sponsors of this podcast, including the OG sponsor, Amazon. Easiest way to support Talk is Jericho. Just go to podcastone.com, click on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. All my Amazon links are there, US, UK, Canada. And remember, every time you use Talk is Jericho Amazon links, Amazon kicks back a small percentage to this show to help us cover production costs. No hidden fees or extra charges, okay? So go to podcastone.com, click on the Killer Deals button, and get your items. And when you buy something, don't forget to take a picture of it. Post it at Talk is Jericho. I will retweet it and follow you. Become a Talk is Jericho Amazon warrior. And check out the rest of my sponsors, DDP Yoga and the DDP Yoga Now app. Go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho and get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app. True Car is there. Uber is there. Everyone's there. Thank you so much for listening. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. And next Wednesday on the show, some call him the greatest of all time. 16-time world champion, you know who it is. Woo! Ric Flair is going to be here for the first time ever. His Talk is Jericho debut, and man, he's a trip. I'm sure the first of many great conversations we're going to have. The champ, Ric Flair, is here on Wednesday. You guys are champs too. Have a safe weekend. I love you guys. God bless you. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy.
Thank you.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
It's like a new pair of underwear, you know? At first it's constrictive, but after a while it becomes a part of you.